Hey everyone, welcome to 10 Movies, the podcast where we dig into the work of one actor through 10 of their movies. I'm Hemal Jhaveri alongside Brian Minter.
All right.
Welcome to season three. So far, we have been talking about the work of Matthew McConaughey.
Absolutely. I am very excited to be podcasting with you here today.
So today we are in episode 5 and we are at the midway point of our Matthew McConaughey season.
Oh, I feel like it just started.
I know, right? It moves so quickly when you're having fun. But this week we are going to be talking about Interstellar.
Interstellar, the vast science fiction epic that for some reason did not win the Best Picture Oscar.
It is a phenomenal film.
It is a fucking majestic movie.
So before we get into talking about Interstellar and then drilling deep down into the Matthew McConaughey-ness of this film, let's take a minute and think about where we are halfway through the season.
Well, interestingly, so here's a little peek behind the curtain for our many, many listeners. McConaughey's career is a three act play, right?
Okay.
He's in the 90s, he's this hot young, he's the next Robert Redford. He's a serious actor, he's got charm, he's got good looks, he's got this ineffable somethingness. He's doing all these different roles. He's a serious guy. He's doing Time to Kill and Amistad, The Newton Boys, U-571, like this real range of movies.
Serious acting.
No, but like they're dramatic roles. Like,
they're dramatic.
He's doing a range of things. Then he turns on a dime, and for all of the aughts, he just does romantic comedy. He's mailing it in. He's just like, you know what? I am a charming dude. I'm a good-looking dude. I'm buff. I'm just going to do romantic comedies and do a couple slight B-movie action pieces. Well, and then,
yes,
the whatever we called the decade we just ended, the tens, another abrupt turn, and now he's back doing serious roles. Interstellar is not the turning point there. It's after that. So I don't know that this marks any particular change in his career, but it is in that third act where McConaughey is a Mr. Serious actor.
So I'm going to disagree with you slightly here because I think that he started off as respectable, right? He started off with A Time to Kill and, like you said, Amistad.
He was the new leading man.
He had all this gravitas in him, even though that's not what his persona kind of suggests. But then he did take a dive into romantic comedies, action films, a whole bunch of B-movies that didn't really work very well. He was still incredibly popular, but I don't think anybody would have called him a serious actor.
No, he was coasting.
Right. And then Interstellar, though, is is like the start of Matthew McConaughey as a serious actor.
I don't know, because when you look at, and I have his Wikipedia page up here. Yeah, literally, at the aughts is all, you know, failure to launch and, you know, fool's gold and whatnot.
Yeah.
When 2011 rolls around, he does The Lincoln Lawyer, he does Mud, he does Magic Mike, he does Dallas Buyers Club and Wolf of Wall Street, all before Interstellar. So I feel like he does make that turn you're talking about. But Interstellar is not it. It predates that.
Okay, but Interstellar feels like the most visible, like, it's like the culmination of all of that, right? Because it's such a huge, epic film.
Yeah, it's a big role.
Right, and I agree with you, he didn't come out of it from nowhere. Like, and in the middle of this, he had True Detective, too.
This is the culmination of the McConaissance,
yes.
If not the impetus of the McConaissance.
And much like the movie Interstellar, which kind of goes back and forth in time, that's what we're doing with this podcast. We are kind of moving back and forth with the McConaughey canon because I think it makes it more interesting.
Yeah, we didn't want to just talk about rom-coms for three episodes. We also didn't want to watch all those things. God forbid.
But let's talk about Interstellar. So,
what happens in the movie Interstellar for those who have not seen it?
I cannot believe that it falls on me to try to explain this because I cannot explain in detail the plot of Interstellar.
I want you to give it your all.
No, because generally what Brian wants is like a play-by-play and
all. No, not true. I just want some respect for the screenwriter's art.
Really, Interstellar is about a man who goes into space to try to save humanity.
No, to try to save his daughter. His daughter is a proxy for humanity.
More detailed summary of this. The film opens in this kind of nebulous future that feels
of a post-environmental collapse near future Earth.
Right. And we know that it's been a very long time because nobody actually has direct knowledge of the moon landing. And it's alluded to that the moon landing in history books has now been proven to be propaganda.
Yeah, it's right? Like something I might return to and bore you with that I won't talk about now. But the movie doesn't ever say, like, it is the year, you know, 2032.
Yes.
You have to, like, there's a scene in that they're at a baseball game, and his father-in-law, John Lithgow, says, "And when I was a kid, they knew how to play baseball." And McConaughey says, "When I was a kid, we were battling for water," or whatever, which makes you feel like we're the John Lithgow generation.
Right.
And so this is like two generations past.
Right. Like it's, and again, this is how great Christopher Nolan's writing is in this film, is that it never needs to tell you what the date is. Like, you're basically going to intuit that it's a very long time from now and things have gone incredibly south.
It's bleak.
So the world is running out of food. The earth is basically being rendered uninhabitable. And through some strange coincidences, Matthew McConaughey ends up at a NASA station.
Well, these strange coincidences are some sort of being, initially believed to be beings from another world.
And they're communicating with his daughter,
yes.
Right? Murph.
Through dust.
Through dust and gravity. Right. So they get in a space shuttle. There are planets out there that have been proved viable, and it is now up to Matthew McConaughey and a small team of intrepid explorers to try to figure out which ones are habitable. They've taken one step. Now they need to take another step.
Yes, there's a wormhole orbiting Saturn. And Himmel's making a face because she didn't want to talk about wormholes. But so it's the important bit here is that there have been these previous expeditions, and they have decided there is, through the wormhole, you get to the other side of the galaxy, there's a dozen habitable planets. But they only have the resources left to go and look at three. Like, there's three of these worlds. One of them is humanity's new home. Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway have to go and figure out which one it is.
That is pretty much the premise of the middle of the film. And then the end happens. And the end is very polarizing. But what happens in the end is basically that Matthew McConaughey figures out a way, incredibly implausible way, to transmit data back to his now grown daughter. So she figures out a way to save humanity, right? She figures out a way to get people off of Earth so they can start colonizing and living on spaceships.
Yes, Matthew McConaughey sacrifices himself to save his pal Anne Hathaway, yet he doesn't die. He finds himself in this sort of higher plane of reality. And then, this is a neat bit, we realize that, like, it wasn't aliens communicating with us on Earth. It was humans from the future.
From the future.
One of whom turns out to be Matt. He was telling himself and his own daughter what to do in the future, which is way better than aliens.
But we're going to talk about the ending a little bit later.
Are we going to talk about evil Matt Damon? Are we going to talk about robots?
We're going to talk about robots. We're going to talk about Anne Hathaway's terrible haircut. And I don't know why
it's
anybody would do that.
Terrible haircut? Why do you?
No. She's a beautiful lady, but that haircut on her is terrible. Why would you do that to someone?
She's an explorer. She's a scientist. She doesn't have time to style majestic tresses. She has planets to explore.
I appreciate that, but there are other ways to do that.
Well, I'm glad we disagree on something, because we both seem to enjoy this movie a lot. So.
Yeah, so like the first thing we usually talk about is whether or not we liked the film. And I will say that I actually liked this movie a lot better the second time I watched it.
I did too, yeah. I enjoyed it in the theater.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I would love to see that again. And I was watching it last night. I was blown away. I was like, this is great as shit. This is a fantastic movie.
I felt the same way, where I was like, oh my God, this movie is actually really good. Now I understand what the hype is all about.
You had seen it before, though.
I had seen it before. And I think that the end, the first time you see the end, it's just so weird and so perplexing that I'm not really sure I was able to wrap my head around it. But now I kind of knew what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to appreciate all the beats much better.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I remember the first time I saw it, like, Wendy and I saw it, and we were walking up behind a bunch of, like, 20-year-old dudes, and they were just like, their minds were blown, and they were like, I think you walk out, and you're just like, what was that thing? And when the thing happened with the thing, why was it? Like, you're trying to process it. So maybe coming back to it a few years later, yeah, you know all the crazy crap that's going to happen, and you can just appreciate the scope of it.
So one thing that he does so, so well is that he gives all of these complicated ideas one sentence, right? Like he does.
Yeah.
The moon landing was faked. This is what people believe now, that the moon landing was fake. It's all about characters. Like, the first time that we see John Lithgow's character, like this grandfather who in any other movie might feel really superfluous, but in this movie feels like he's really needed.
Yeah, he grounds the family.
He, like, grounds his family.
And it's a great touch that he's not Matthew McConaughey's dad. He's his dead wife's dad. He's his father-in-law. So and there's a little bit of tension in their relationship.
He's doing this wonderful thing where he's making breakfast, but he's like wiping all the dirt off of the dishes. Here's a person doing an act of love versus the grandfather sitting down and telling all the kids one by one, hey, I love you, pal.
Yeah, the movie really sketches out all these characters without a lot of time spent on them.
Yeah.
And the setting, too. Like, one thing I love is that, like, the Christopher Nolan's filmmaker respects the audience's intelligence so much. There's never, like, it is 2032 in the dust. Like, he doesn't explain it. It just drops you right in. Or there's these great robots in the movie, and they're totally different from every, like, sort of movie android. It looks like a person. There's no explanation of these things at all because the characters aren't bothered by that. So no character goes, oh, you see, Matthew McConaughey, these are like, no one explains anything. You just have to follow along because that's what the characters are doing.
And I think that's why people sometimes find his movies hard to process. And I think that they benefit from being watched like the second or third time.
Yeah, clearly. Another, if I may, since we're just being wrapped here. One thing, this movie has tons of ideas in it. It just packs all this stuff. Every new set piece is a new crazy scientific concept you have to wrap your mind around. And I'm totally fine with this idea that, like, to fully understand this or to appreciate this on a certain level, you need to go and do a little exterior research or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens in your Star Wars and your Game of Thrones, it's like, oh, you have to go to Wikipedia and read about this imaginary thing some dude made up.
Yeah.
Here, though, he's trying really, really hard to, like, convey actual, like, complex scientific concepts like relativity and artificial intelligence and all this stuff. You know, the effects of, you know, time dilation when you approach a black hole. So I bet tons and tons of people have gone on to the internet to be like, what the hell was that thing? What did that mean? But when they do that, they are learning about a genuine, interesting scientific concept.
Right.
That's great to do that.
No, it's incredible. He didn't just make up weird science because it served the story. Like, the story had to fit around actual science.
One of the executive producers is Kip Thorne, who is a, you know, very prominent astrophysicist and like consulted, like made sure that the
that's
science
incredible.
Was as good
as
it could be. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is what makes the movie feel so good is that it's that grounded. I think this is a good time to transition into the cast because this movie stars Matthew McConaughey. And he takes up a huge chunk of it, but it is littered with big stars.
Yeah, tons of great actors and tons of, like, again, like we said, like, not even big roles, but, like, really strongly sketched characters that these people are bringing to life pretty
and
well.
Very meaty. So John Lithgow plays...
The father-in-law.
Father-in-law. Surprising twist, young Timothy Chalamet.
Right? I wouldn't have known who that guy was when I saw the movie 4 or 5 years ago, but right.
Timothy Chalamet blowing up. Very good as Matthew McConaughey's son.
Who is later performed by Casey Affleck.
Then you have...
Little girl, the younger version of his daughter. Who's that? She's great.
Her last name is Foy. I looked it up, and now, of course, I can't remember it.
Yeah, what else was she in? I loved her.
I don't know, but she's fantastic, right? Yeah. The little girl grows up to be Jessica Chastain.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. Anne Hathaway as Brandt.
Brand. The doesn't start as the love interest and isn't really the love interest, but you know.
She's a partner.
She's his partner, yeah.
Yeah, she's his partner, which I think is
and
really awesome.
Toward the end, though, they do suggest that they have feelings for one another, which the movie would have been maybe stronger without that.
I don't know. I think we'll talk about this in a little bit, too.
Doesn't
because
he go to the... Okay.
No, he does. But we'll talk about this because there's enough ambiguity there that I think I really enjoy it.
Okay, all right.
Who else is in this film?
Let's see. I think David Gayassi's his name. He's the scientist who gets stuck on the... he gets stuck back on the ship. Okay.
Ellen Burstyn as... Older.
Yeah,
older.
So you're right. Three actresses portray Murph.
Yes.
The girl, whose name I can't remember, Ellen Burstyn when she's old, and Jessica Chastain when she's a middle-aged woman.
And then an evil turn by Matt Damon. Evil Matt Damon.
And they kept him out of all the marketing, so he was a genuine, like, surprise to moviegoers.
It was
but
genuine
not
surprise.
Evil, right? Like, just, he's
evil.
Weak. No, he's, well, he commits evil actions.
He crumbled under the pressure. But let's...
Great scene.
Oh my God.
With...
I'm going to kill you.
So at one point, Matt Damon and Matthew McConaughey are struggling on this slope of scree, and there's ammonia in the air, and he breaks his faceplate, and Matthew McConaughey's like covering it, and he's flipping out, and he's going to breathe in this ammonia and die. Matt Damon leaves, but he keeps turning back. Be like, oh, I can't watch you die. He's like, he can't stop talking to this guy that he just murdered. It's so good.
It's so good, but you know what it also is? It is... absolutely a fight between two middle-aged white guys, right? Because it's not like they do all kinds of crazy...
Oh, yeah, they're just lumbering at each other.
Just, like, pushing each other and yeah. then like knocking heads a couple of times.
But like two middle-aged white guys fighting in spacesuits yeah. in non-Earth gravity would fight that way.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Even though these people have very small roles, they're just like incredibly distinct. Oh, we didn't even talk about Michael Caine. Yeah, Michael Caine too.
So Michael Caine, he's the father. So I think the movie, the primary relationship in the movie is Matthew McConaughey and his daughter, Murph.
Mm-hmm.
And then Matthew McConaughey leaves. He goes out to space. He leaves her behind on Earth. In a mirror set of characters, Michael Caine, who is his old mentor, stays on Earth, and his daughter, Anne Hathaway, goes out into space. So Michael Caine is the kind of wise scientist figure who we think is trying to solve this equation that will get people off of the Earth out in space. We learn later that he was lying all along.
Yeah.
He just wanted to kind of trick. Again, he wants to trick these people into going out because they are taking these human embryos. They're like, he doesn't believe the human race can be saved. He wants to just save the species. There's this deathbed scene, though, with him where he's dying
yeah.
and he's sort of confessing to adult Murph.
Mm-hmm.
I genuinely couldn't tell what he was saying at least half the time, but I kind of love that, right? Like, this guy is literally dying. He's mumbling. You kind of understand what he's talking about, but you don't really catch all the words.
I don't know if that was... It was scripted, obviously, but I don't know if it was intentional that you couldn't understand all of his words. But I had the same problem because I was watching it. And I was like, I kind of don't know what he said.
But I feel like that's a directorial and acting choice, right? Like,
yeah.
they're like, yep, you know what? Just mumble like someone who's dying and the audience will figure it out.
Well, also because it doesn't really matter, right? Like, we don't really need to understand the science behind it to understand
yeah.
that... this is hopeless.
I feel like that is maybe one of the areas where the science in the movie is weakest. That, like, there's this... like, that's one of the times where there's
yeah.
a plot MacGuffin, right? Like,
yeah.
the only way they can solve the equation to save the human race is to get this information from a black hole.
Right.
And how are they ever going to do that? And then yeah. in the end, Matthew McConaughey does it.
Well, speaking of that Michael Caine deathbed scene, what I thought was hilarious is, and I think a really weird directorial choice because we hear this poem three times in the film, is the Dylan Thomas.
Yeah, do not go gentle in that good night.
Like, I got it, dude.
Too much,
I got
yeah,
it.
Totally.
Like, yes, I understand what you're saying. So I think that's a lot to... before we talk about the Matthew McConaughey-ness of this film,
we should talk about the role of women. How are women treated in this film?
I know that's everybody's least favorite topic.
That's not true.
I kind of do want to talk about this because we're just coming off of Sahara, and I say this in Sahara, too. We're literally only allowed one woman in this space expedition. Hello, Anne Hathaway. And her terrible hair. You can have a whole group of people, but there's only ever
oh,
one
right.
woman.
She's, there's the black guy and the woman,
yeah.
and then the two more distinct white male
exactly.
characters.
Like, you're only allowed one woman in any group scenario where you're going anywhere in a movie. Literally only one woman.
Now, there are two female roles that are central to this movie. There's
yes.
his daughter, his relationship with his daughter, which is
right.
the central relationship of the film. And then his relationship with Anne Hathaway, whose father is also a character in the film.
Films do this all the time, which is that there are strong female characters in movies, and these strong female characters very rarely actually interact with each other. They are constantly always just interacting with the men in their lives.
Yeah, so. Those two only talk in that kind of pivotal scene where Jessica Chastain
yeah.
talks to her over the video to tell her father's died,
yeah.
and also he lied to
exactly.
you.
Exactly. So it literally is still always women as they relate to men. I'd like to see more than one strong female scientist talk to another strong female scientist.
Yeah, I agree. He's doing the minimum. And again, like, a lot of these roles, there's no reason why women couldn't be the exact same character and
yeah.
deliver the same value for the movie.
But so much of the other stuff in this film is done so well that I'm gonna let it go.
Here's a question we don't normally talk about. How did you feel about the score?
Last night, this is so funny that you bring that up because I debated.
You just made Matthew McConaughey goggle eyes like, bruh!
Because I was like, oh my God, the music in this is phenomenal. And
it's overpowering, but in such a cool way.
Yeah. And the thing is that I'm not one of those people that actually responds, like, thinks very much about music in films. Like, I know a lot of people really do, and they take it very seriously. To me, it's like very much a limited part of the experience. Except in this movie, it was used so well.
Oh, yeah. It's not only really present, it's really pumped up. Like,
yes.
you hear it. And a lot of times the music is actually telegraphing the emotion or the arc. Like, there's this, you know, in a couple scenes, like, the music picks up and it gets really tense, and you're like, oh shit, what's gonna happen? And then something does happen.
So, one scene where I think this is really relevant, and the scene that I was thinking about, is the scene where they first meet Matt Damon. They get to the planet where Matt Damon is, and we don't know yet that he has falsified a ton of this data, right? We think that this might
yeah,
be a...
we think he's a good guy.
We think he's a good guy, And they're having their first conversation with him. They wake him up from cryo sleep, and he's kind of explaining all the data that he found. And he's like, oh, I sent out a couple of probes.
Yeah, when you go down to the surface, you can breathe the atmosphere.
And the first time that I watched the scene...
God damn it, Matt Damon.
The first time I watched the scene, didn't notice it, was watching it again last night. The music is so sinister during that scene. It totally telegraphs...
You know something's going to happen.
...that Matt Damon is a no-good lying piece of... S-H-I-T.
The robots didn't trust him.
No. Nope.
Why did the humans?
So, yes, I think the score is great.
There's another...
And it's by Hans Zimmer, so, of course.
There's another... So, yeah, one of the things that, like, again, there's so much movie in this movie. Like, there's a whole bit about they land on Matt Damon's planet, and, like, that could have been a whole movie. And then the first planet they go to is Wilson's planet. There's this explorer named Wilson. She landed there. And, like, so... This, like that, to come back to the idea that there's 13 movies in this movie and what the music does, they land on Wilson's planet, and as they're going down, they realize that, oh, because it's so close to this black hole, time is vastly sped up there.
So crazy
this is the best, maybe the best single piece in the movie.
Yeah.
So they realize that time is sped up, so they have to make the decision. Well, if we go down to that planet, you know, 7 years pass on Earth for every hour, we have to get in and get out. And they tell, Robley, the scientist. He's like, hey, I'm going to stay back on the ship. I'm going to be here alone for a couple years, but I'm going to do some gravity research or whatever. So they go down to the surface. It's this water planet. This is so good. This blows my mind. Go interstellar ocean planet scene on YouTube just to watch it.
It is. Yeah, it's really incredible.
And Anne Hathaway gets out, and there's just like this shallow ocean, and they're looking, and then they realize like, oh, the Wilson's dead. They're finding like the wreckage of her ship.
Yeah.
And Anne Hathaway says like, oh, there's some more over here, over towards the mountains. So this is an amazing bit. Like you see her walking towards these distant blue mountains. Because I had seen it before. You watch that. In another shot, you realize the mountains are actually closer, but the characters haven't noticed.
Yeah.
And the music starts picking up. And then eventually, it cuts to McConaughey, and he says, those aren't mountains. Those are waves, which is terrifying. But the music tells you something is about to happen before it happens in a great way.
And the thing with that planet scene, too, is that he telegraphs the tension in that scene is already incredibly high because you know that every second counts, right? Every second that they are down on this planet
His children's lives are slipping
away. They're just like, people are getting older and older and humanity is dying. So the tension is already incredibly set for the scene. That's before the waves even get there.
The number of like emotional... So yeah, the stakes are really high and they're really clear. And again, this is really weird science, but you understand what's going on. The wave comes... The other guy, I don't remember his name, dies. He's killed by the wave.
Wes Bentley, right.
Wes Bentley gets killed. Anne Hathaway, it's not like she's being impetuous. She sort of screws up. She costs them a bunch of time, which turns out to be like 23 years.
Right. Like they get back to the ship and that guy has been living there.
So they're going back up to the ship and Matthew McConaughey's furious and Anne Hathaway, she's beating herself up and she realizes, I've cost us 23 years. You're so consumed with what they're going through. You're like, oh shit, his children, a third of their life is gone back on Earth, and he's been really focused on getting home. You don't even realize that then they open that air hatch when they're back up to the mothership. There's that guy who's been there for 23 years all by himself. It's awful. It's so terrible. It's just like within the space of maybe 10 minutes, like six things wrench you. And that's just one little part of this movie. It's nuts.
It's so crazy because it's this like incredibly compact, like, 6 or 7 minutes of film, right?
Yeah.
It is 7 years are going by for every hour. Giant waves are going
to
crash at
waves
you.
The size of Delaware
right.
coming
this
to kill
you. This planet is actually not habitable. That guy has been on the
robot turns into a cartwheel and saves her, which you didn't even know the robot could do.
That guy is up there chilling by
himself. Poor guy! And then he gets blown up on the next planet by Matt Damon. That guy had the worst mission.
He was not alone a good time.
For 23 years, and then a couple of days later, he got exploded by evil Matt Damon.
So, are we ready to kind of move on to the Matthew McConaughey-ness of this movie?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. How do you feel Matthew McConaughey is at the center of this movie?
I think he's phenomenal, and I cannot believe. I don't know if this movie won any awards.
It didn't. I went back and looked at what won Best Picture that year. And it was Birdman, which was great, and I loved it. But it was up against The Imitation Game and Theory. Like, all these, like, nice, pleasant Oscar-baity movies. Why didn't this win? This was so much better than all those movies.
This is actually an incredible role for him, and I think he's phenomenal in this film, start to finish. And I know, like you said, he's done a lot of stuff before Interstellar, but like, I don't think, I definitely did not realize like the depth of like the empathy that he brings to this character.
Yeah, he's really on top of his game, and he really brings so much to this character and isn't like overdoing it. And is like,
no.
And I think it's still like, it's a very McConaughey-ish role. Like, we talked about the McConaughey vibe being like his sunny optimism, his confidence, and all that's there. He's very like American the whole time.
Let me run down really quickly for our listeners at home about some of like our defining McConaughey characters.
The McConaughey strengths.
The strengths that he brings as an actor. The expressive eyes, the big goggly eyes.
Now, I feel like he's not leaning so much on Google eyes here in this final third of his career.
Yeah, he's absolutely not.
He's moved beyond that.
He's got the smolder. He's got a drawl.
But does he smolder in this movie?
Yes.
I feel like he puts his sex appeal on the shelf.
Well, okay, let's talk about it for
a second. All right, yeah, get through the list.
Let me get through the list.
There are protocols to be observed.
So we got the smolder, the drawl.
Drawl, yeah.
Laid backness. Confidence.
Confident, yeah. Very confident, very,
very competent. Very confident. And I already mentioned kind of his eyes and his facial expression.
But you think he's smoldering here?
I think that he looks really, really good in this film. He might not be smoldering towards anybody else, like, in the film. He is freaking smoldering to everybody in the audience.
But, like, I feel like now he's just, like, before he was, like, Mr. Super Hot all the time.
Yes.
Now he's, like, hot dad.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's absolutely true. Now he's hot dad.
Hot space dad in this movie.
Here's the thing. It might be because I am of a certain age that hot space dad is more attractive
he's
to
really
me.
He's really ringing your bell. I feel that.
It's just more attractive to me than when he was like laid back surfer guy. But he keeps his freaking clothes on throughout this entire
There's
film.
There's no shirtless scenes, but they would be very out of place in Interstellar.
Would.
It's a very serious film.
They could not shoehorn a shirtless scene into
I think he's still like, I think this character works as this very like, you know, very competent, very confident, cocky guy, very grounded. But I don't think I think he's putting some of the old McConaughey, hot surfer dude tricks on the shelf because he doesn't need them.
I think that's a really, really good point. I think that he's scaling back a lot of the stuff that he was kind of overplaying in some of the earlier films, right, that were a lot more frivolous. Like the confidence. Like, it's underlying and it's there, but it's not as cocky.
Yeah, he doesn't telegraph at any point, like, I know what I'm doing here, baby.
So let's go to the very start of this film, because I think that you really have... The first time you see him on screen, in the first, like, 10, 15 minutes where he is being a dad, are crucial to us really liking this character.
He's a farmer. He's a dad.
And that's where he has... That's where being Matthew McConaughey really comes in, because you know that he's a little bit of a rebel. He doesn't actually really like the farming life.
Yeah, the character feels tied down by his circumstances, and McConaughey is very believable as that.
Yeah, and you kind of really have to get into it. He's like a cool dad without being a joke of a cool dad.
Yeah, he used to be a NASA pilot, and now he's a goddamn corn farmer.
Right.
He's not wild about that.
No, and you know, he's cool about his daughter. Talking about space conspiracies.
He wants his daughter to be, he likes that his daughter is smart. He likes that she's bookish and then she wants to explore stuff.
Yeah, and he has a very surfaceable relationship with his son, Timothée Chalamet. So I think that in the very beginning of this film, like, it's very essential that you, like, that relationship between him and his daughter is believable. And
yeah, it broke. So at one point, he's apparently, and this is where, you know, the movie that is not entirely believable.
Mm-hmm.
There's NASA has kind of gone underground. They're still working on this secret mission to save humanity. He shows up and they're like, oh my God, Matthew, you're the only guy who could pilot this mission, which is not, you know, that didn't. So he goes back home and he wants to do this. Like, we know that he longs for exploration, longs for great things. He leaves his family.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, it's heartbreaking. Like, I hated that he did that. And, like, you could argue that, like, well, he's doing it for them, right? Which I think the rest of the movie tries to really foreground. Like, he never loses sight of his kids back home. He's doing this for them in his own eyes.
Right.
But it's brutal when he leaves his family. It's awful. But that wouldn't hurt or feel that way if you didn't believe that he was really this kid's dad and he's trying to be a good dad.
Yeah, and even though he is not the perfect dad, right? It is so many times in films people try to make these characters one-dimensional, and they say that, well, like, family is everything. But he has enough of a rebel side in him, like that personal side that yearns for space exploration, right? Like, he could have stayed at the very end of the film. He could stay with Murph, right?
Oh, when he comes back and
when
she's
he comes
near
back
death.
And she's near death. But she's very much like, you don't belong here with me.
That
like,
is an emotionally wrenching scene.
Yeah.
And again, like, it's a testament to this movie that and the ideas it puts in that, like, he is now seeing his daughter and she is twice his age and they're like they're recognizing each other. That's a great, and it feels like, and you feel like you're actually seeing this happen with two people who would be in that position.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you have to accept all this crazy time travel crap.
To me, this film, this leads probably a good way to segue into our next question, which is, does this movie have to star Matthew McConaughey?
I don't think that it does. Like, you could see another actor of like, it couldn't star Keanu Reeves, God love him. or, you know, it couldn't star Brendan Fraser. But, yeah, you could see someone else, you know, your Denzel Washington or maybe Matt. Like, someone else who's got a lot of range could sell this character.
I absolutely think that this film needs to star Matthew McConaughey because you need somebody that's a little bit of a cowboy but still lovable enough that...
he's the last American cowboy.
Yeah, would still really love his daughter and his son and yearn for them but still be driven by that, you know, feeling of wanting to be out in the stars.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I absolutely think this film needs to star Matthew McConaughey.
I'm glad it stars McConaughey.
Yes.
I feel like... I think we mentioned this earlier, like McConaughey is the lead man. He does a great job here. Christopher Nolan, the reason the movie is so great is that Nolan's complete vision. I feel like he could have delivered just as good a movie with someone else, but I think McConaughey is great in this role.
I think the temptation is to cast somebody like Matt Damon as the Matthew McConaughey character. His name is Cooper, by the way, right? Like, it's
Cooper.
Because
this is his name.
This comes out before The Martian, but we've seen in The Martian that Matt Damon does a really good job as space guy, and he probably plays a really good space dad. Christian Bale probably would have been good in
Christian
this.
Bale as space dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like you said, like the tension of what the character wants to do versus what the character feels obligated to do. Yeah, and someone who is a more straightforward space dad, you might not get that. That dramatic ennui.
As a really good space dad.
What to you is the quintessential Matthew McConaughey moment of Interstellar?
I don't know if I have a very good answer for this because I was so like lost in the fog of this entire film. It's probably just a bad line reading, and this is not being fair to Matthew McConaughey because he's fantastic in this film. But they're getting ready, like it's a climactic space scene towards the very end, and all the space shuttle is breaking up.
Oh, that's a great scene!
It's a great scene, and
Matt Damon has inadvertently blown the airlock and damaged kind of their mothercraft.
Right, their big ship, they're on the little express ship. I don't even know what it's called. I'm sorry.
I believe it's a lander.
Okay, yeah. They're on the lander, and they have to dock with the space station.
Yeah, because their space station is spiraling down into the atmosphere. It's going to be destroyed. And it contains the embryos that are the hope of the human species. And here's another great bit. This movie has these amazing tonal shifts. That scene where McConaughey has to, like, dock and save the... It's just pure space action movie, right? There's not like, what's the character going through?
No. It's just, like, straight action. But, like, in that moment, I think TARS is one of the robots is asking him a question or something. And Matthew McConaughey is like... It's not because it's possible, but it's because it has to happen.
It's necessary.
It's necessary. And I was like, there it is. That's the most.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a coach line. You're right.
There's the Matthew McConaughey.
Also, does a robot need a pep talk?
I love TARS in this film.
Oh, the robots are great.
The robots are great.
So for me, the most emotionally affecting moment in the movie, which I think is the strongest piece of acting McConaughey does in this whole movie, when they come back from the water plant, they've lost 20, his back on Earth, 23 years have passed. Also, this poor guy is stuck on the ship. So video messages from Earth have been piling up. So his son is like a lesser character in the film. Like, it's this father-daughter relationship. And in fact, when he leaves Earth, his daughter, she's so upset, she won't talk to him. This big scene. His son is like, hey, Dad, man, can't wait. You know, go out in space, have a good adventure. Can I use your truck?
Can I have your truck?
Yeah. And he's like, oh, man, you just said a good boy. I'm going to see you soon, buddy. It's almost like he's going to the store or
something. But I have to say that it's not callous, right? I think that there's enough...
Yeah, the son doesn't need...
Right. There's enough love in there that you understand that... It is not that deep, but it's certainly not cold. Yeah, go on.
Well, so again, like the texture of this movie. So yeah, this relationship with his daughter is really important. But the video messages piling up are from his son, who is now played by Casey Affleck as an adult. And his son, we have already been told, is like, he's not like the daughter. The daughter is smart. She's got a future. His son's like, well, he's going to be a corn farmer like his dad. That's all he's good for. He's this middle America forgotten kind
of. And he's perfectly happy with that life.
Yeah, he's happy with that as his life. But you don't expect the movie's going to give that character any depth. But then he has all these video games. He's talking to his father, who he believes is dead, is not even listening. He tells you that, you know, him and his wife had a son. He holds him up in one message. Then later you realize that the baby died. And then later in the movie, you get from this son that, like, he's kind of an avatar for these people that are lost and forgotten. Like, he doesn't even want to be saved. He's so despairing. So, again, a little minor character, but beautifully sketched. McConaughey is watching, you know the scene. McConaughey is watching this accumulated 23 years worth. He is seeing these children, his son's life that he has missed. And his son is holding up the baby and like, hey, say hi to your grandpa. And it cuts back to McConaughey many times. And all he's doing is he's just
sobbing.
Weeping. Yeah, like he can't control his tears. It's like maybe it's an obvious choice there, but it's such like beautifully done. Like you totally believe the pain in this guy. Like it hurt my stomach to watch this guy watch his son's life vanish. Like he missed all of it, and there's nothing he can do about it.
Matthew McConaughey in that scene is so insanely believable. He's such a good crier on screen.
Yeah, because it's ugly and there's the pains all over his face. But he's not like going, no, or anything like that.
Exactly. Like I imagine that crying on screen is actually very difficult. And he makes it, I'm not going to say makes it look easy, but it's so believable that you kind of want to turn away. Like, please.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, like, it feels like almost obscene to be watching this.
And that's how I felt during that scene, which is that Christopher Nolan, man, that guy really knows what he's doing because he holds on McConaughey for so long that you feel uncomfortable watching this. Like, it's too intimate to be witnessing this man watch his children's lives progress without
all
him.
All alone in a dark room watching a low-res video.
And that scene can also be super cheesy, right? Like, if one thing goes wrong in that scene, like McConaughey messes up or Christopher Nolan makes different directing choices, like, that scene can be like, this is weird and cheesy.
Yeah, if you get a whiff of, no, it would suck.
Yeah.
And, like, it's not like he's watching birthdays and weddings. He's watching, like, the destruction of his son's life, and he wasn't there to help.
No.
And he couldn't have helped, probably, but, like, and you know, if you're a father, like, that is the greatest failure, right? Like, he was not there to protect and make his son feel better through any of this.
Right. And the gut punch of that scene is that after the son does all the videos, he kind of thinks that it's over, but then Murph comes on.
Oh, right. That's the first time we see that Murph has left a video.
Yeah, it's Murph. She's now grown. Jessica Chastain.
Is that the first time we see Jessica Chastain as that character?
Maybe. I can't remember. But it's the first time that he sees her.
And she's still so bitter. She's still so pissed.
Yeah, and she's still angry. And she's like, guess what, Dad? I'm the same age that you are when you left me. It is a freaking gut punch of like 45 seconds.
Yeah, and again, a way to take this like esoteric concept that most people don't even quite understand and use it as the hinge for all these like emotionally wrenching things.
My question for you, actually, is about how you watched it as a father, because you've got a young daughter. And Elliot also has pale skin and red hair.
I don't think this is a, like, oh, as a father, I appreciate it on a deep level. But yeah, I was there. The moments where, like, he has his greatest moments of challenge as a father, like when he leaves his daughter, like, I couldn't, tears were in my eyes. I could not watch that scene because she's a 12-year-old girl, right? And her only thing in her life is her dad, and he's leaving her, and she doesn't understand it, and she's furious, and she's hurt. And I could never have done that. Even if I knew, like, oh, this is the only way to save my children and all of humanity, I still could not have dragged myself out that door.
And I think that's Michael Caine's point. That's the Dr. Brand's point, which is that I don't know how many people would make that self-sacrificing choice.
He's not as good a father, Michael Caine, the older Dr. Brand. Like,
he's a little sketchy.
Yeah, there's not that big bond between, like, when she finds out he's dead, she's unhappy about it, but... Yeah, like that scene and obviously the scene where he realizes that he's missed.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think that's like the great tension of this character, right? Like he's doing this heroic thing. He is saving humanity and he pulls it off, or he's at least enabling his daughter to save humanity. But he's still like he succeeded as a human being, as a hero, but he failed as a father. Like he had to fail as a father to do all these like greater things. But that sucks, right? That's not your job as a father to do greater things. It's to be there for your kids. And he didn't do it.
Yeah, I think that's the incredible tension of this film, is that the sacrifice that he's making is being a terrible dad. Like, yes. Sacrifice is not that he's going into space. The sacrifice is that he's abandoning his kids, right? Because one of the questions is like, oh, well, is he a good father? No.
Yeah, he's not. He's not a good father, but he couldn't afford to be a good father.
No, he couldn't. He had to kind of make that. But again, that's the tension that I think is really good in this film.
And part of it's a script and the direction, of course, but like, it's McConaughey to embody that tension and make you care about this guy.
Right, because you have to think that there's a little bit of him that steers toward ne'er-do-well, right? Like, that's the little part of McConaughey, not in a bad way.
I hope someone someday says about that at me, that like, there's a little part of me that steers toward ne'er-do-well.
So we are going to talk about where this fits in the Matthew McConaughey canon.
Where does it fit in the Matthew McConaughey canon?
But before we get to that,
sorry.
Before we get to that, I do want to talk about whether or not this movie has a love story in it.
Hmm.
You seem to think that towards the very end, it does dovetail to love story.
Well, like, the love is very clearly like the explicit text of the film, right? Like, there's several big speeches about love.
But not just romantic love.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could have made this movie a lot worse if it had just been driven by romantic love. But it's all kinds of love.
Yeah, the central loving relationship is him and his connection with his daughter.
Right.
And, like, the other big relationship is Anne Hathaway's in love with the scientist who we never meet, mm-hmm. Edmonds, who's died.
Right.
But, yeah, the main bit of the whole movie is, or the sort of the linchpin of the whole movie is, at the end when he's floating in extra-dimensional space, the only thing he can count on is that, like, even though I betrayed my daughter and abandoned her, I still love her, and I know that she still loves me. She will come back. So, again, if you can't remember, he encodes this data in this watch that he left for his daughter, and he knows that she will come back for that because he gave it to her.
Yes, this very strong belief. But, again, my question was about...
I don't remember your question. Oh, is there a love story in this movie? Well, yeah, of course, right? We just talked about two of them.
Right. It's not. My point was that I don't think actually it's a romantic love story.
Oh,
like, you're talking about
and...
the very end where he, you know, sees Murph right before she dies and kind of completes that circle and then takes off to go find
Hathaway. He somehow magically escapes from the black hole. He returns to Earth, or to at least what's left of Earth. They're in the spaceship leaving Earth.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a man out of time, right? Like, they're like, oh my God, you're that guy who left 120 years ago.
Right.
So, yeah, like, he's like, well, I don't really belong here anymore. And he goes to find Brand, Anne Hathaway, who is the only human being who is now on what will be the future home of humanity. You don't think he was going to find her in a, like, she's going to be my new girlfriend kind of way?
No, I don't. Huh. I think that I understand why the movie might make you think that, because we want to project like that heteronormative happily ever after kind of fantasy onto two single people everywhere. But I think that it's really about the fact that they became good partners while they were in
space. There is no romantic attraction between they're bonded over like crazy crap,
exactly,
but there's no romantic spark between them at all,
exactly. And I think that, to me, this movie, and I wish that this is more explicit because you never see this in films, is that they have a great relationship, right? Like, they fight and they argue and, you know, they work really well together, but for 90% of the film, there's no romantic tension, right? It doesn't even try to make you convinced that, like, oh, maybe something's happening with these two.
Yeah, she is motivated, just as he is motivated by love of his daughter, she is motivated by love of the lost scientist that she idolizes.
And so they are strictly, like, two people working together, and they have a great bond, a great partnership.
So when he goes to get her at the end, he's just going back, like, she's the only other person in the galaxy now who's been through what he's been through and is out of time like he is.
He has a very strong bond with this person, and whether or not that's romantic, my point is that it doesn't have to be romantic for it to be meaningful. It's this incredibly meaningful bond that they have. And it does not need to be romantic. Maybe it will be because they're both super hot and they're both going to be on a planet alone together.
But
before...
you feel like her hair will prevent him from having those feelings.
That is a disastrous haircut, Anne. I'm sorry that they stuck you with it.
It's not the most flattering, maybe, but it's not a disaster. It's business hair.
It is business hair, but she can do business hair better. Anyway, the point is that I love that little bit of restraint at the end because, like, yes, he's going to her, but you know, a lot of people want to read romance into things.
Like, I think you're like, I don't think that's in the movie. I think I just read it because, like, oh, well, they're like the male lead and the female lead.
Right.
Yeah, and they're both attractive. And why wouldn't they get together on this desert planet?
Yeah. All right, let's talk about canon. Where is this in the Matthew McConaughey canon?
I don't know. What do you think?
Top. It's like top three.
Yeah, I feel like this is a movie everyone knows him in. This is a movie everybody saw. He does a, like, he's great in this movie. Yeah, I feel like this ranks highly in the McConaughey canon.
I think that this is, like you said, he's not the return of him as a serious actor, but definitely like the peak of him as a serious actor. We're not going to be talking too much about True Detective on this podcast, but this is very much in line with the work he did on True Detective. Like, it's so emotional, so vulnerable, and like you said, doesn't lean on any of the stuff that he did before. It's a departure, but in a really good way.
Yeah, this is not a movie that requires its main actor to carry the film. Like, the film itself is so full of film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, a lesser actor would have gotten lost in this role.
Yes.
And he's very present. He's at the center of the movie the entire time.
Speaking of, can we talk about the movie MVP?
Who did you feel was the MVP of Interstellar? The character that perhaps was unheralded, not who was not McConaughey, but in your eyes is the most valuable player.
So I know that the movie MVP is supposed to be anybody else but McConaughey.
Yeah, you can't make McConaughey.
It has to be McConaughey.
This is contrary to podcasting protocol.
Look, for me, nothing in this movie like works without how great his performance is, and he carries so much of it that.
What about Jessica Chastain with her?
I mean, I think she does, but I was gonna say that if it's actually Matthew McConaughey, but if I have to pick somebody else, I'm gonna pick Tars the robot.
Me too. That's who I would pick. Tars is my favorite character in the whole movie.
Tars.
But, and so, and lest you know.
I thought you were going to say Young Murph. I thought you were going to say the actress who's Young
Murph.
No,
she was great.
She's great.
I think Casey Affleck is, like, in a tiny role, does a great stuff. But yeah,
Tars the robot.
And not because that's funny. Like,
right.
The robots are, like, you see robots in all kinds of science. There's C-3PO and Data and all these, like, robot tropes.
Yes.
So this, like, not only is the character design is mind-blowing. You're like, what they're, you know, if you haven't seen the movie, they're just, like, four rectangular pillars connected on some
it's
kind of central
big
axle. Yeah.
Metal box.
Yeah, like, you don't think you're going to warm to these things at all. But it gives them, and they're so plausible. Like, that's what, you wouldn't actually build C-3PO.
Right.
You would build these, like, crazy adaptable super boxes.
Yes.
And the movie manages to make them, like, really human and empathetic without ever, like, you know, a critical scene is when Tars, you know, drops into the black hole to, mm-hmm. like, shoot the, to give the, you know, added momentum to the ship. Anne Hathaway can get away. And she says, like, we can't ask Tars to do that. And Tars is like, I'm a robot. It's, you know, it doesn't matter at all. I'm a machine. Like, so they don't, that scene could have been, like, no, I'm gonna do it, Anne Hathaway, because
yeah.
I'm your robot. So yeah, the robots are really human and they're really empathetic, and also they're weirdly heroic. Like,
yes.
There's a scene, I don't think it's Tars, I think
it's Case, yeah,
who saves her on the ocean planet. You didn't even know they could spin around like a daisy,
yeah.
Until they do. But that, like, that him, the robot doing that to save her, and he saves her just in time, and the music's swelling. You're like, that is a hero robot.
Yeah, it's incredible how attached you get to these.
Yeah.
Faceless robots, just through the voice acting, which is phenomenal. Tars is voiced by some guy named Bill Irwin, who I bet is probably really famous. Oh, Tars is also the robot that first knows right away that something is fishy with Matt Damon.
He didn't trust Matt Damon.
He didn't trust Matt Damon.
He disabled the auto lock.
Yeah, he's like, this is messed up, dude. But what he's able to do with this, like, and it's such a cheat to make that robot look human, and Christopher Nolan stays away from it.
Yeah, like, yeah. You earn, like, when you first encounter the robots, they're kind of in a menacing role. They're like,
yeah.
Ex-security robots. And you're like, why is Matthew McConaughey arguing with this crazy slab of metal?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you get to know them over the course of the film, and you love them,
yes.
But yeah, there's never any, like, they're never BB-8, right? We're like, oh my God, they're
so
cute.
Yeah. And you don't even give them human names. It's just Tars.
Tars and Case.
And Case.
And one is dead that Matt Damon killed, and you're like, oh man,
yes.
You killed one of those cool robots that we love.
Movie MVPs.
Joss Whedon, J.J. Abrams, all you people that make science fiction movies, watch Interstellar just to see what he did with those freaking robots. Do more of that kind of thing in your movies.
I'm really impressed because I have come out of this with a really renewed appreciation for Interstellar.
Same here, yeah. From the robots to the John Lithgow to the Interstellarness.
So before we wrap up the podcast, we are going to get to the movie that we're going to be doing next week. We're going to get to some reader fan mail. But I'm worried that I might be opening up a can of worms here because I want to know if it's worth trying to explain the ending, Brian.
I'm emotionally drained from just talking about this movie this much already. The ending, as we alluded to, is probably the most controversial and maybe the weirdest part of the film.
Yeah.
What happens in the end? What did you think was happening there?
First time, I had no clue what the hell was happening in the ending. The second time, to me, it seems like humans in the future...
Future humans
who have realized that wormholes allow you to move through space and time and to push gravity through space and time knew Matthew McConaughey was going to be floating around in space like this because they can move through time.
He drops into the black hole to sacrifice himself.
Right.
They pluck him out somehow.
They pluck him out, or they knew he was going to be there. They build a tesseract, which if you've ever read A Wrinkle in Time, you know what a tesseract is.
Right, right.
That's what a tesseract is. It's a wrinkle in time. And they built this little tesseract for him to move around in so that he can communicate with his daughter.
Yes, he is in a fourth dimensional version of his daughter's bedroom from when she was 10.
Exactly.
Or from throughout time.
Yeah, so basically it's a little time warp that he is in. They open it because they know he's going to be there, and then they close it.
And he's floating in a spacesuit. Tars the robot is still also alive and communicating, which is really like need him. He has to be able to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing this in the theater for the first time. I think like it's such a weird visual. Like, and again, there's no visual language for this. Like, what does it look like inside a fourth dimensional cube? Nobody knows. Nobody will ever know. So they choose to do this like infinite cross section from behind the books.
Yeah, it's basically just like a really weird, long, big library.
But I appreciated that there's nothing you can't show, so you have to show something. But like what in the early part of the movie, you think that there are aliens, right? And mm-hmm. the movie doesn't dwell on it, but he thinks and then it asks people like, oh, there's anomalies and we're being communicated with by some higher intelligence. The whole time you believe it's going to be aliens, which is a little bit of a like. That's not in the movie. It's kind of a Deus Ex Machina. The realization that hits you is like, oh, there weren't any aliens all along.
Yes.
The person communicating with his daughter 20 years ago was him from the future. Like, that's great, and it's beautiful, and this is the way the movie visualized it, and I'm fine with that.
Are we ready to... Any final thoughts? Brian, any final thoughts?
I'm exhausted. I feel like I've been shouting in this microphone for hours.
I urge you to tweet
us
your thoughts.
I'm thirsty because you won't let me drink anything because it will make noise.
That's true. Before we wrap up,
this is the Death March of podcasts.
We have so much more to get
As we through. Enter the third hour of our Interstellar podcast, a movie from 5 years ago, there are already at least 50 podcasts about. We hope you are still with us.
Well, I hope you're still with us because we've got a couple of important things to get through. Before we talk about the movie of next week, let's do some reader mail because we have listeners.
Yes, the best listeners out there. And I urge you to join their number as a subscriber of the 10 Movies podcast.
First, I want to shout out to Joanne, who has been a longtime listener. Joanne, we love you.
Woohoo! Joanne, keep it real.
You're great.
Leave us a review, Joanne.
Yes, if you haven't already. Clifford, who loved Reign of Fire.
All right, several people loved Reign of Fire. And I am suspect about their taste.
I was surprised that actually other people had heard of this film, but I'm very glad that they have.
A mutual friend of both of ours, Sarah Lyon, apparently mm-hmm. a big fan of Reign of Fire. She's a woman of questionable taste, so I will forgive it.
Sarah, I'm with you. It's a phenomenal movie.
If it's on TBS and you're already sitting on the sofa, give it a watch.
Two other pieces of reader mail that I want to get into. One from our friend Sari, who listens to this podcast and will not stop texting me about how we should talk about Christian Slater next.
I don't understand that. Is there a movie he's in with? Oh, she means she wants... Well, no, we can't watch 10 Christian Slater movies.
She is petitioning very hard for us to do a Christian Slater season. Not totally related to this season, but Sari, we love you and we love your enthusiasm.
And I love that you're sending pictures of Christian Slater to Hemel. Keep it up.
Finally, from Cheryl.
Alert reader Cheryl Huber.
Yes. Who has petitioning for us to do Fool's Gold?
Now, Cheryl emailed us to say that she was watching Fool's Gold. You were watching it at the same time, but you were not. We're not going to talk about it on the podcast, so you were doing extra work for no reason. You were watching unnecessary McConaughey movies.
Let me read a tiny bit of Cheryl's email because I think it's really funny. her selling point for this film is that
Fool's Gold.
Fool's Gold. It features Malcolm Jamal Warner with a very weak Caribbean accent.
Oh. Theo Huxtable, as anyone will know him by.
Matthew McConaughey, shirtless 80% of the time. Some amazing underwater hijinks and the best reggae soundtrack.
Oh my! What are the underwater hijinks?
They do a lot of diving.
No, this is a romantic comedy, right?
Romantic adventure comedy, which kind of seems to me like a mix of How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and Sahara.
Who is the lady in Fool's Gold?
I believe it's Kate Hudson.
Oh, Kate Hudson again.
Yeah, Kate Hudson again. Anyway, Cheryl, one correction: he's shirtless 90% of the time.
Is Fool's Gold good? Did you enjoy it?
I will say that I actually enjoyed the 10, 15, 20 minutes of it that I watched more than I enjoyed the movie that we're going to be talking about next week, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
Ooh, good segue. That's professional podcasting work right there.
So yes, next week our podcast is How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, romantic comedy from early 2000s, 2003, I believe.
Deep in the trough of McConaughey's career.
People love this movie. It was suggested multiple times by multiple people, so we're going
to
talk about it.
A friend of mine from work ranked it immediately as the best McConaughey romantic comedy.
Okay, that's highly questionable, and I'm going to need names.
People on the internet like it, too. If you read the best McConaughey romantic comedy list, this is almost always number one.
Okay, well, if you are still with us in, again, hour 8 of this podcast, just stick around for next week.
Next week when we will watch Interstellar again and spend an hour being like, ooh, remember that one bit when the thing happened and the robot fought the guy and they went into the thing? It was awesome.
Oh, thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. We'll see you next week.